now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for downloading the very latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. Today, I'll be joined by Nancy McLean, a professor at Duke and the author of a really important new book called Democracy in Chains. It pulls back the curtain on the influence of the Koch brothers and the radical ideology that they embraced that was advanced by James Buchanan, a guy you've probably never heard of and everybody should know about. It is rooted in the segregationism and Jim Crow of the Old South. And it is a virulent virus that we need to confront. This podcast is made possible by listeners like you who subscribe at peterbcollins.com, including Benny Alto, Patrick Array, Abby McMillan, and Susan Lundgren. I'd like you to join their ranks so I can keep this whole machine going. Come on over to peterbcollins.com, click on the menu button, then pull it down and click on Become a Subscriber. It'll take you to the sign-up page, and I hope you'll choose to take action. Today on the Peter B. Collins podcast, we look at the origins of modern libertarianism and the racist inspiration of it.
I'm a white man living in a white man's world. Under our roof is a baby girl.
Little music I found on Spotify. Jason Isbell is singing about being a white man in a white man's world. And we're going to delve into a very interesting subset of American thought with Professor Nancy McLean. She teaches at Duke University, where she is the William H. Chafee Professor of History and Public Policy. And she has published recently a powerful book called Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. Professor, thanks for being with me today.
It's great to be with you, Peter.
And I do want to shift a little blame here. It was one of my listeners who lives in Hawaii, John Zweibel, who tipped me off to your book when it was published, July or August. And I've spent some time with the book, and John's touting of it, I think, was very much on target. Could you describe the kind of reaction that you have been getting to this book, both positive and negative?
Well, I think if your listeners go to Amazon, they'd probably see it displayed there. The Amazon reviews are neatly divided between fives. I think about two-thirds of them are fives, and and one-quarter is ones. So they are sharply polarized. And on the one hand, ordinary readers and people who are trying to figure out what has happened to American politics seem to be finding good answers in this book and loving it, and many have written me wonderful letters like John, and I appreciate his shout out to you to get me on your show. And then the cause that I'm writing about, members of it have also been looking at the book, and they seem to be doing their best to kill it. Some of them actually, ironically, without having read the book, but they want, they kind of home in and find what they hope is a little chink in the armor. And so they've tried to discredit the book discredit me and my reputation. But really, I think what's happening here is exactly what you see with this libertarian cause and climate science denial. So, even though most of us who are part of the fact-based world know that 97% of scientists agree that global warming is a man-made problem and that it desperately needs attention, we have a powerful libertarian cause that wants to deny that that's the case precisely because it so hates government, it refuses to acknowledge the science. And so they're kind of going after me in the same way that many of them have gone after climate science. scientists. And they're really evading the central point of the book, which is the deep history it provides for this current effort by extreme right-wing billionaire donors to transform our government and ultimately our society without actually telling the people that that's what they're trying to do.
And we're going to learn about the involvement of billionaires like the Koch brothers, the Olin Foundation, mm-hmm. Richard Mellon Scaife, and many of the people who have funded this move to the right and a real attempt to return to oligarchy that is, shamefully based on the era of slaveholding. And really taps into some of the deep racism that we saw Donald Trump exploit for electoral purposes in the last couple of years. And now that it's, kind of out in the open, the Charlottesville March really made an impression. And we're going to talk about Charlottesville as part of this story. But I learned a lot from your book, Professor, about the role of black students and parents in Virginia who challenged segregation, became one of the cases that was folded into the landmark Supreme Court decisions of Brown versus the Board of Education. And even after the U.S. Supreme Court had ruled, rear guard forces in Virginia refused to accept it and looked for every way they could, including shutting down the public school system entirely as a way of avoiding integration. And so there is a rich and equally dark history to this. And it began because you gained access to the archives of James Buchanan. Explain to our listeners how that happened.
Well, yes, and you've done a brilliant summary of sort of the arc of the story there. Actually, I did start to research this story as originally a kind of civil rights meets free market fundamentalism story. So I didn't get access to Buchanan's archives until later. But from all the other archival research that I had done and my reading of his works and other primary sources, I became convinced that he was a crucial element in this, linking this older 1950s right to what we're seeing now with this extremist billionaires donor network. And so his papers were not in any archive of the kind that historians usually consult, professional archives. They were not listed anywhere. So I only found out late in the game that he actually had a private archive at George Mason University in Virginia. And when I first tried to get access to it, I wasn't able to. They didn't respond to my calls. They didn't do anything. But he died in 2013. And after he died, I was able to get in. And it was just absolutely stunning as a research experience. I'd never had one like it in terms of the chaos of the records, but also the riches I found in those records were actually, I stopped breathing at a few points and had to remind myself to breathe because they confirmed what I had come to suspect about Buchanan's ideas having provided the operational strategy for the Koch donor network's efforts to transform our politics.
And Professor, it sounded like when you got into those Buchanan, we can't call them archives, but his collected papers, it was like going into Grandpa's attic. It's just piles of
nice
stuff.
That's a nice way to put it, yes. Yes, they were completely unprocessed. They were just in the condition that, someone, if you died suddenly and everything that you had was left behind in an office, in a busy office, where lots of people had worked, that's how it would have, been left, and that's what I found. But it was even worse because Buchanan had quite a temper and quite a sense of his own importance, and so he had actually been pushed out, not by liberals, but by conservatives from two places where he worked because mm-hmm. they got sick of him, kind of throwing his weight around and trying to dominate all decision making. So he left, and he wasn't a particularly good filer, and neither was the woman he called his gal Friday who came with him from one institution to another. So the papers were just in chaos and totally helter-skelter. So as I said, I've never had a research experience like it. On the other hand, I have written several books, and I have never happened upon things that seem so kind of momentous and urgent for our contemporary political situation. So it was a mixed experience of, you know, kind of shock, but also feeling glad that I could share this information with people.
And the central focus of the book is on James Buchanan. And he was an economist trained at the Chicago School, and he became kind of the architect for the Koch brothers and others who were looking for an ideology that would persuade at least a certain element of the electorate to give them unfettered power and to reduce the power of the state. And late in the book, you cite the editor of Salon, David Daley, who said that the goal was to establish a veto-proof supermajority operating without majority support. Now, I want to repeat that and yeah. let people really yeah. absorb this, because this is the crucial mission of these individuals, a veto-proof supermajority operating without majority support. And I would submit that we are there now, that yeah. it's most glaring in the Republican majority in the House, which is a function mm-hmm. of gerrymandering. And let's be fair, Democrats used gerrymandering when they were in the majority as well. But
never like this. Never, yes. never to this degree of, you know, scientific precision and also total heedlessness for the will of the electorate.
And so what we have is emerging a government by and for the wealthy at the expense of the rest of us. And Trump and his crony capitalist gang really epitomize this in a very vivid way.
Yeah, well, I think also the health insurance discussions, the push to repeal Obamacare with this horrible, you know, a series of horrible bills that do not get anything near majority support. You know, the last one never polled above 16%, never got majority support in any state in the union. Not even a majority of Republicans supported it, and yet the Republican Senate was, you know, just pushing at breakneck speed to get this thing through. And that left many people understandably scratching their heads, saying, why would this party want to impose, even on its own voters, a health plan that they think is terrible and that they don't want and that they've raised their voices against? And what explains it, I believe, is what the Koch donor network learned from Buchanan about changing the rules and changing the incentives of our politics, so that now the Republican Party is answerable to these extreme right billionaire and multimillionaire donors convened by Charles Koch, and not even to its own constituents in its own party. So it's really a frightening thing to behold.
And Professor,
but it does show, you know, a kind of strategic genius on their part. They knew what they wanted. They had all this money to invest to do it, and they are essentially using that money to radically change our political system.
Your own voice gets stronger in the final chapter of the book, Professor, when you write, to value liberty for the wealthy minority above all else and enshrine it in the nation's governing rules, as Buchanan and others called for, and the Koch network is achieving, play by play, is to consent to an oligarchy in all but the outer husk of representative form.
Yes. It is really, you know, I'll tell you frankly, there were times as I was researching this and I began to realize how audacious this vision was, and this plan for transformation, and I began to see the connections among the literally hundreds of at this point of organizations that this Koch donor network funds. There are dozens at the national level, and if you include the state level and the international level through something called the Atlas Network, and at the state level, the State Policy Network, there are hundreds of organizations, and they are ostensibly separate, which keeps all of us, you know, not really paying attention because they all seem like they're advocating one one particular thing, rather than us realizing that they're part of this kind of more integrated network, what Koch called interrelated plays. But it is just, it's a breathtaking plan by some of the richest and most right-wing members of our society to change our society and indeed the world through this Atlas network. So it's really something. And to get a sense of how audacious it is, their end game, I believe, is to change our Constitution. And this is something that some reporters have covered, although not enough by far. But the liberty, this liberty cause, as they like to call themselves now, the liberty movement, they are seeking to change state constitutions and they're seeking to change the federal constitution. And they're actually pushing towards a constitutional convention. Now, listeners should bear in mind that we have not had a constitutional convention since 1787 because it's such a radical thing and it could so dramatically change our country. But this donor network has now lined up, counts vary, but either 27 or 28 of the states needed to convene, of the 34 states needed to convene such a convention. So they are very, very close to convening this convention. And if they do manage to convene it, what they want to do is push through fundamental changes in our foundational rules, our Constitution, that will empower this wealthy minority and that will put locks and bolts on what the majority can do in the way that we have over the course of more than the last century. So it's that radical a vision that they're after and that audacious an endgame.
What you just said is really powerful, Professor, and I hope people, even if you want to hit rewind and listen to that last part again, you know, you've offered a really important set of observations with an indictment and a warning that, you know, these powerful individuals are really, you know, rolling forward with a lot of momentum. There are a lot of politicians who have signed up to support them. We know that Republicans control over 30 of the state houses with one-party rule in the legislature as well as the governorship. And when we see the role of ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, which you properly note for its influence, that is the conduit for a lot of the state-level, quote-unquote, reforms that are being pushed that really roll back much of the progress that we have seen since the New Deal.
Yeah, actually, and in truth, even the progressive era. This cause does not like things like the Pure Food and Drug Act of the early progressive era. They actually would like to see us go back to indirect election of senators. That was a demand of, you know, the People's Party and of the progressive era to have direct election of senators. They actually want that to go back to state legislators. They understand that fewer than 20% of people on average pay attention to state government, and that skews wealthier and older. So if they can control state governments, as you pointed out, they're increasingly doing with control over 30 states, they can do a lot to transform our society. And this is a message I've really been struggling to convey to some of the people in the blue bubble, you know, when I was just in Manhattan. And, you know, there are some people who are paying attention, but there are a lot of people in, you know, the so-called blue states of America, what we in the South sometimes think of as the free states at this point. But a lot of those people just don't really understand how much ground this arch kind of extreme right has already conquered and how close it is to victory because of its control over the state governments. So this cause, again, by focusing on the state governments, it can both restrain what the federal government can do, as it did to President Obama on some of his climate initiatives and coal, you know, clean coal and so forth, and it can also restrict what local governments can do. And so we've seen these Tea Party right, you know, whatever you want to call them, Freedom Caucus type dominated state governments stop local communities from raising wages for municipal employment, from, you know, demanding higher, better health care and stuff from, you know, city contractors, from even passing passing plastic bag ordinances. A Republican community in Texas found the state government overruled them on that. So it just goes on and on, this kind of abuse of power at the state level to undermine democracy at the local level and at the federal level. And that use of states' rights against the federal democracy at the federal level and the local level goes back to something you raised earlier in terms of the connections between this strategy and John C. Calhoun's thinking in the early 19th century.
Mm-hmm. And a couple of things I want to follow up on what you just said. Number one, this use of preemption, where a state will say that a local government may not, pass an ordinance or a law in a specific area, has reached absurd levels. And there's now a challenge to a state law in Texas that prevents a city from declaring itself a sanctuary, essentially decreeing that anyone, must follow the dictates of the state government. Secondly, you referred to an effort to roll back the direct election of senators. And I just received an action alert from Common Cause this morning. It opens with ALEC. It says, ALEC has drafted a new plan that would dramatically limit voters' ability to hold Congress accountable by taking away your right to choose who should represent you in the U.S. Senate. Now, many people aren't aware that 100 years ago, senators were chosen by governors, I believe, and sometimes they were confirmed by a state senate. But there was not direct election, and I believe there was a patchwork. It wasn't the same in every state. Am I correct about that?
I don't remember the patchwork, but definitely it took a constitutional amendment to make sure that ordinary voters could vote for Senate candidates rather than have it, go through state legislatures.
Now, what is the motive behind, rolling back direct election? I would think that the big money interests believe that they can buy Senate seats, particularly in red states, and that this might interfere with their ability to pack the Senate with friendly votes.
Yeah, again, this is part of this whole chilling vision, and it is a systematic attempt to change the electorate, to change the rules of our politics, to make it so that these would-be oligarchs, basically, can achieve their vision. So, exactly, why would they be doing such a thing? And also, I just want to maybe back up a little bit and provide a little historical context for your listeners. We already have a situation, before this project got going in earnest, where numerous political scientists and economists, some of the best ones we have, I'm looking up at a bookshelf full of their books now, we're all saying, hey, we are in trouble in America. Our system is on the verge of becoming, even some people in like Ivy League schools started using in their publications the word plutocracy, right? That money so dominates our politics, and particularly the U.S. Senate, where it costs a fortune to get elected now, and many studies have found that our senators at this point are so responsive to moneyed interests and pay almost no attention to the needs of people who are like the bottom 50% of the income distribution, which is obviously most people. And so we are already in a tough situation. And also, we already have the world's only constitution that has what political scientists call four veto points. Others maybe have two veto points, three, sometimes one. We're the only country that has four. And we also have the worst inequality in our country. And that's just one measure of how our Constitution already restrains the majority, already makes it very, very hard for us to do things that even, as much as 85% of the people wanted. That's how many people supported the Civil Rights Act, Title VII, by the time it passed. So it's already difficult in America, and this libertarian cause and its academic advisors want to put more roadblocks up to government acting on the popular will, and that's what these proposals to have the Senate candidates elected by state legislatures rather than direct vote. That's what they would achieve. And also, as you mentioned, the huge gerrymander, that's already misrepresenting the popular will. And also, I mean, we already have a constitution that because each state gets two senators, what that means is that the vote of someone in Wyoming is about 700 times more weighty than the vote of someone in California. So, we're already in trouble in terms of the unrepresentative nature of our political system, and this cause is determined to make it worse, both by the measures that you described, with having indirect election of senators, but also by this these extreme voter suppression bills that they have passed in the states that they control, including my own home state now of North Carolina.
Well, and Professor, I want to now kind of return to the Jim Crow era to look at the origins of some of this philosophy. My guest is Nancy McLean, professor at Duke, author of this new book, Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. So if you would, take us back to the 1950s, when Senator Harry Byrd ran Virginia and was described as an oligarch. And he was one of the chief resistors to the Brown versus the Board of Education ruling that ordered schools desegregated and ordered, essentially a fair playing field, a level playing field for every student, regardless of race. Explain Harry Byrd and then how Jim Buchanan came into this a little bit late in the process of the Virginia resistance movement.
Yeah, this whole prehistory was fascinating to me, and I think it's probably also would be of interest perhaps to your listeners, because it really confounds some of the ways that we think about our contemporary world. So often today we hear people talking about race and class as though they're separate, race and class problems or issues or constituencies. And what I saw in Virginia is that the same people who like Harry Byrd and Howard Smith in the House, U.S. House of Representatives, the same people who opposed the New Deal, who fought Social Security, who did not want workers to have the right to organize in the Wagner Act, who did not want to have progressive taxation, those same people were the people who were the diehard opponents of civil rights. And so, yes, Harry, after the Supreme Court in Brown versus Board of Education in 1954 had said that segregating children by race in public schools was unconstitutional, the state of Virginia, pushed by Harry Byrd and a newspaper editor who was close to him, the state of Virginia led the wider South in something called massive resistance to Brown versus Board of Education. And massive resistance was not one thing, but a whole suite of legislative measures. They included tuition, what we would call today school vouchers, tuition grants for public, so that tax subsidies would go to parents who wanted to put their children in white segregation academies. That was one element. Another element would require the governor, going back to our preemption discussion, would require the governor to shut down any public school that was about to desegregate. Now, since black children were suing to end desegregation and whites weren't, that meant they would shut down white schools. So by the fall of 1958, when the court, things had moved through the courts and were coming to the enactment stage, there were three communities in Virginia that were about to let a few black students into formerly white schools. And at that point, the governor shut down schools in those communities. And they included Charlottesville, lately much in the news, where the University of Virginia is. And they included Norfolk, where there was a big U.S. naval base, and a textile city called Fort Royal. And they locked out 13,000 children from education for the whole fall until they were stopped by the courts and a mobilization of white parents. So this is, this was pretty shocking stuff and pretty bold defiance of the federal government on, in the name of states' rights and white supremacy. And James Buchanan, the Chicago-trained economist, moved to Charlottesville right in the midst of this. The laws were passed in 1955, 1956, that winter, and he arrived in the fall of 1956. And with the support of the state government and former governor of the state, who was heading the university, set up this new center of political economy and social philosophy, as he called it. And so it was absolutely in that crucible of the civil rights struggle.
And it's just stunning because I was born in 53, okay?
Uh-huh.
And I remember in grade school, I at some, you know, public or a student gathering, I read from the decision of Brown versus the Board of Education. And I thought I knew about that, okay?
Yeah.
But I didn't know about the Virginia component. I didn't know about this effort to shut down all the public schools as a way of avoiding desegregation. And I did spend some time in the Deep South when I was about seven. My father moved us there for about 9 months. And so I was exposed to, you know, water fountains and other public facilities that were labeled colored. But I have to tell you that this is very important history that has not been given appropriate emphasis, at least not in my education, and I had a pretty good one.
Yes, well, you would maybe feel a little bit relieved for your own memory and gratified to know that I have a wonderful writing group of some very great distinguished historians, one of whom is a Southern historian and one of whom is a legal historian who also does a lot of work on the South. And both of them were shocked by this story of the 13,000 white children being locked out of schools. It was news to them. They didn't know about it. And I think the reason for that is that so much of the literature and history that we have about the civil rights movement focuses on the Deep South, on, you know, places where there were violent conflicts, like, you know, Mississippi above all, but it's really neglected, you know, the sort of upper South or border South, as it's sometimes called, where things were a little bit more gentlemanly, you know, there was less violence, but there were things like this. These, and again, it comes back, circles back to what we were talking about the present, this radical rules change to promote the interests of oligarchical interest in a state. And in fact, just before, less than a decade before these events in Virginia, a great political scientist said, was talking about how oligarchical the state of Virginia was, and that it was the most oligarchical state in the South and therefore in the nation. And he said, next to Virginia, Mississippi is a hotbed of democracy. So if you really know about Mississippi, that tells you a lot. But because these guys maintained their power with carefully, shrewdly designed rules rather than violence, we know less about them.
Yeah.
But I think going to this Virginia story is therefore illuminating for our own time in which radical rules changes are being pushed through to achieve related ends in terms of maintaining the power of elite of an elite that otherwise would not be there democratically. And this is very interesting, too. You know, it's hard to get most people to pay attention to gerrymandering. First of all, the word is too long. I think we need a better word. You know?
Rigging.
But second of all, you know, it's one of those, you know, tricky, or it seems tricky, but basically it means that your vote doesn't count because somebody counted you out, right? So that, and what this meant in Virginia, they had a legislature that was so gerrymandered to overrepresent rural conservative interests and underrepresent suburban and urban, more moderate voters, that those massive resistance laws would not have passed, historians have shown, if the representation was one person, one vote, as it should have been. You know, that it was only through that misrepresentation, overrepresenting the conservative interests and underrepresenting the moderate and liberal interests, that they were able to push through these laws that did so much damage.
Well, I agree with you. Gerrymandering is an arcane term. I refer to it as legislators choosing their voters.
Yeah.
And here in California, I do not have much good to say about the governorship of Arnold Schwarzenegger. But before he left office, he teamed up with Common Cause, and they passed a Citizens Redistricting Commission. And our congressional districts are now drawn based on rational factors and not a backroom deal where we're protecting Senator so-and-so or Assemblywoman such-and-such. And it is, I think, a model for the nation to work with or to adopt. And it does provide for much fairer elections where the voters get to choose their representatives, which I think is the way it's supposed to work.
Yes, that's a good story, and we need success stories, I think, now to be models. In my own state, there's litigation pending against this horrible gerrymander that was done to North Carolina after 2010. And my own district in Durham, North Carolina, has been described by David Daley, whom you cited earlier, and I believe in some litigation, as, get this, a snowball hitting a windshield and melting. Mm-hmm. That's how bizarre the crafting of that district was. I mean, it's like this weird blob. And we have districts now in North Carolina that reach from the mountains in the west to the coast in the east. And again, as you say, they're designed to perpetuate, in this case, a radicalized Republican Party in power, the will of the voters be damned.
Well, and Professor, North Carolina is the laboratory for voter suppression.
Yes.
You have seen every available means used to reduce Democratic registration, to mm-hmm. fence out students and early voting, to use photo IDs to, keep a certain subset of older, typically African-American voters from participating. And the list goes on and on.
Yeah, absolutely. And North Carolina, yes, this cause boasted about North Carolina being a prime laboratory of what they called the Big Bang after the 2010 elections, the Big Bang of radical measures that they were going to inflict shock and awe style, which they did, and which has turned, in policy terms, a state that was long the leader of the South in terms of efforts to develop a strong public education system that helped North Carolina to go from the poorest of southern states to the wealthiest, best off in mid-century, and a whole lot of other things that were sound public policy and moving toward inclusive democracy. All of that was abruptly cut off by this new radicalized Koch-backed legislature, and radical changes came through one after another. I mean, it's almost and so people who lived here for a long time just couldn't believe it because they thought about their state as being this very moderate, state of the Upper South, one that had been committed to education and so forth, that was suddenly just becoming, competing with Mississippi in terms of the level of funding for schools, the kinds of public policies that we had on other matters. So it's really, really a stark change and a kind of U-turn. And again, it's Exhibit A of what we've been talking about if you have some very wealthy and determined and ideologically driven, I would even say messianic, donors who are determined to impose their vision on a state or the country as a whole, in our current climate where you can have all this dark money and have all these donors funding institutions without the people knowing about it, you can really achieve radical change.
And, Professor, beyond their efforts to change the electoral system in order to favor the interest of oligarchs, the mm-hmm. efforts to modify the education system really are driven by some of the same philosophy that segregationists embraced. But as you alluded to a little earlier, and I'd like you to expand on it, the Betsy DeVos, the Secretary of Education, really is the new poster child for the moves by the libertarian right to reshape the education system. And I'll add that Charles Koch has been buying professors and institutes at higher learning institutions all across the country. Mm-hmm. And really, his relationship with Buchanan in some ways was the model that has been expanded upon. But when we talk about vouchers and charter mm-hmm. schools and the use of the term choice, which, of course, is proscribed when we're talking about a woman who might seek an abortion, but is glorified when we're talking mm-hmm. about parents who will take their children out of the public school system, robbing it of funding and other resources, to shift to a charter school. And in many respects, there are African-American charter schools. But my impression is that, by and large, charter schools are the havens of white flight. where people have abandoned the public schools, and there also is a Christianist element to it, where evangelicals have created charter schools so that they can operate outside constitutional limits on separation of church and state.
Yes, I agree with all that you've just said. I think you've laid it out very well. Betsy DeVos, her appointment is, in a sense, a kind of culmination of these now decades of systematic ideological attacks on the public education system. Actually, they go back to the New Deal because some of these older conservatives couldn't believe that their children were starting to think that, you know, people had a right to retirement security through Social Security, or that workers had a right to organize through the Wagner Act. So they became convinced that public education had done these horrible things. So the beginning of the hostility to public education in ideological terms goes back to the 1930s for the Northern Right, although Southern oligarchs like Harry Byrd had never really liked public education because they didn't like the government to provide anything for the people, right? The public sector to provide anything. But now, since the 1950s, and this fight that we were talking about over Brown, this libertarian movement, of which Charles Koch has been the leading funder, this cause rallied to the side of the southern states that were shifting tax revenues away from desegregating public institutions to these private segregation academies. And the whole, as far as in my research I found, like, all the libertarians who commented on this applauded, even if they might say something about segregation, which very few did, but, you know, one or two, but they still said, isn't this great that we're getting away from the horrible public sector to private schools? So it's really a deep ideological commitment. And for the first time, with Brown versus Board of Education and the Southern Schools Crisis, this libertarian cause had access to a potential mass base of voters and people who would support it. And they saw that and went on to transform the Republican Party. You know, they made Barry Goldwater their candidate in 1964 and, you know, have been busy changing that party ever since. But as you say, they've been also pushing for Christian, you know, tax monies to go to Christian schools, for monies to go to home schools, et cetera. And Betsy DeVos is very much pushing that agenda from her position at the Department of Education, as the Secretary of Education. And the other piece of this is also important that you point to, which is how this Koch donor network is establishing these beachheads in institutions of higher education, actually in a particularly shrewd way, because in some of these places, like Virginia, where they have such control over the state government, they put big cuts into public education budgets, higher education, and then administrators are scrambling, needing money to fund things, and they come in as donors. And they approach these desperate administrators saying, hey, we've got some money, and all we want is for you to set up this center here. And many administrators have done that. And I tell the story of George Mason University, where this is the worst. And the Kochs have actually established their, I call it an academic base camp, right over the Potomac from Washington, D.C., where at George Mason, through the economics department, what's now called the Scalia School of Law, after
Great.
The right-wing justice Antonin Scalia.
My hero.
And something called the Mercatus Center. Through this little tripod of activities at George Mason, they are radically changing the country from the base of an institution of higher ed. And the way that they have done that is, to my mind, I can't think of another word just now, but devious. Mm-hmm. They have donors fund searches that are ideologically defined, which is not something you see in other parts of higher education. You know, so they'll say, we want the so-and-so professor of free enterprise, you know, or we want a law and economics professor, or professor of public choice. You know, there's only certain people who will apply for that who come out of the cause, who are trained in these ideas, and it's a short list, so they're not very competitive, so that, and it's almost overwhelmingly men and white men, so these guys who would not be competitive for, say, an open political science search or an open economics or law search come in through these short lines and then basically use the higher education position to advance the Koch agenda. They recruit for Koch operations. They push policy to advance this. Sometimes it's a requirement of their jobs that they get out there and do op-eds and speak in the public eye and so forth. But it is really a kind of a hijacking of higher education for this extremist donor cause. And it's really pretty appalling. Now, one good thing I can report, one really interesting, exciting thing that some of your listeners might want to look into, is that young people have started to organize against this, and they've built a great group that is called UNCOKE, with a K,
yeah.
UNCOKE My Campus.
Uh-huh.
It came out of actually George Mason and Florida State, where there was another one of these beachheads, but they're now organizing at about a dozen of the, now get this number, over 300 campuses where the Koch's now, Koch Donor Network has funded activities on campus, but they are organizing. They are very active in researching and exposing how these implants are undermining academic integrity and public transparency. And they actually, I think it was just yesterday or today, went to court suing the students after being stonewalled for 5 years from the George Mason University administration. The students went to court and sued under Virginia's Freedom of Information Act to get access to these special donor agreements that the Kochs have made that are unlike other donor agreements. And it's kind of breathtaking to realize that young people, who are citizens of Virginia, have had to sue for access to the records of a Virginia public institution. But that's the point that we've reached in all this.
Well, I love to see the activism. Now, Professor, if you could, can you thumbnail Buchananism or his economic philosophy for us? Because I think people will be shocked to learn just how extreme it is. I would summarize it as the central theme is protecting wealth, property, and capitalism from the intrusion of government.
I think that's a good summary, a very nice, concise summary in terms of its goals and objectives. And I can just, maybe spin out a little bit more on that. But absolutely, I think the ultimate mission was, and it was actually summarized by, I believe it was the Cato Institute, which is, was started out as the Charles Koch Foundation. But they summarized the gist of Buchanan's work as being to protect capitalism from government. And so Buchanan was part of what some people have called free market fundamentalism, what some people have called neoliberalism. But the group of thinkers on the right and predominantly in economics who came out of the University of Chicago in the 1940s and 50s and built an international organization. I know you have listeners from other countries, so this might be of interest. They built an international organization called the Mont Pelerin Society, founded in 1947, which made the case for these free market fundamentalist policies, over the decades. And in fact, that organization now is heavily laden with Charles Koch operatives, people in his various organizations that he funds and these Koch professors that we just talked about. But anyway, so there was this Mont Pelerin Society organization that was pushing this this notion that the free market was the answer to all problems, and that the whole world had gone in the wrong direction in the 20th century. And so Buchanan was in this group, but he was different from some of the others. So your listeners may have at some point come across Milton Friedman, who was a very vocal advocate of this free market philosophy. He wrote a book called Capitalism and Freedom that was very popular. And I think of Friedman and Buchanan as kind of the yin and yang of this cause, because Friedman was this like sunny, genial guy who was always making this positive case for what capitalism can do and what the market can do, and freedom to choose, and language like that. But Buchanan was kind of like the dark side of that. He wanted to make a case against government and to argue that government was systematically incapable of doing the kinds of things that people look to it to, because, and this was his distinctive contribution, if you will, as it was called, he applied this free market thinking to actors in the public sector, whether elected officials, agency officials, union officials, etc., and said that they were really just individuals seeking their own self-interest, and that they were misleading people when they said they were seeking the common good or the public interest. So it's a deeply cynical philosophy. Buchanan actually said he wanted to tear down the idea of the public interest that was dominant when he set to work in the 1950s. And so he systematically set out to change the way that people thought about government, and ultimately to get to the point that that change in thought about government would lead to changes in the rules and in policy. And so by the 1970s, he was advocating what he called constitutional revolution. He didn't think that any constitution in the world adequately protected the rights of the minority, he would say, but I never saw him show interest in any minority except the rich, not political dissenters, not civil rights people, et cetera. Anyway, I'm going on probably too long here, but basically the idea is to use these Chicago-style economics tools to look at government and, frankly, to discredit government. And I think so much of what we hear today in the rhetoric of Donald Trump and his supporters about the swamp, about crookedness, and so forth, that's really coming out of this school of thought that Buchanan founded. I mean, it has academic credibility. There's lots of people, you know, involved in this. They're not all on the right. They're not all right-wing activists, but the right has really grabbed hold of this, not least because Buchanan pushed it with right-wing funders and corporations for so many years.
So after, as you referenced earlier, Buchanan was pushed out by fellow conservatives from the University of Virginia. He had a brief stint at UCLA, which appeared to really shock him to see these damn liberals in California and just all of the
attendance. And Angela Davis was the most popular professor, and the faculty and students were supporting her rights to free speech and academic freedom over that, you know, the interests of Ron, you know, the animus of Ronald Reagan and his right. Board of Regents. Yes, really
so
interesting story.
By 1970, he had run back to Virginia, where he was invited to set up a new shop at Virginia Tech. And this appears to be where he really cashed in with Koch and Olin and Scaife and learned how to trade his, hardline economic philosophy and political theories for, very substantial endowments. And this led to the Third Century Project, which is about 1972. Explain that for us.
Great reader. This is wonderful to have such a well-prepared host. Yes, so Buchanan, you know, as we were talking about, was already, you know, on the right and identifying with the right when he set up shop in Charlottesville in 1956. And he just became steadily more appalled as the 1950s and 1960s continued. And I just found this amazing archival trail of him reacting to things, including the desegregation of the University of Virginia and the schools there and the end of the poll tax and the end of the gerrymandering and, you know, all these kinds of things. He was getting angrier and angrier. And then he went to UCLA, where he saw, you know, the Black Panther Party and the Black nationalists, you know, fighting it out on campus. Angela Davis, as I said, was the most popular professor. The movement against the war in Vietnam was surging. And he became furious. He was livid. He said it was a world gone mad. And he became determined to develop and train what he called the counterintelligentsia. And at one point, he actually said conspiratorial secrecy is at all times essential in this, and in this Third Century Project, as you picked up on what he called it. And his idea was that America's first century, which basically we could say when there wasn't real democracy, you know, when so much of the population was not enfranchised, to the second century, when government began to do all these things that he and other libertarians disapproved of. Well, he looked at those two things. He wanted to have a third century where this libertarian cause would kind of define the agenda, and it would roll back that whole 20th century model of government. And again, not just back to the New Deal, but even back to the Progressive era. And so he began to systematically convene various partners, including Ed Meese, who was Ronald Reagan's, you know, right-hand man, and others, and these right-wing foundations like Scaife, like Olin, to, as he said, create a gravy train for these right-wing academics and other right-wing figures who would be in the news, who would be shaping the conversation. And so he was really, he was kind of on that job before almost anybody else was in the early 1970s. And through that, I found in the archives, that's how he also came to work more closely with Charles Koch, who had started funding intellectuals on the right, libertarian thinkers, in the late 1960s, but began to do so more in earnest in the 1970s. And so Koch and Buchanan began to work together in various things, including what became the Cato Institute. Mm-hmm. And then Buchanan became a kind of gatekeeper, even in this project, where he would run these seminars for something called the Liberty Fund, for example, and he'd send in reports to the funders. He would evaluate the people, you know, kind of a, like an ABC scale, you know, of who was going to be good for the causes hardcore and who wouldn't. So the partnership really developed from there. But the 1970s was absolutely pivotal in this connection between Koch's money and Buchanan's ideas about political economy, which then Koch in the 90s really invests in a big way.
And he also became a lead advisor to Augusto Pinochet, who was the brutal dictator who had arranged for the assassination of Salvador Allende and taken power in Chile.
Yeah, this was a really stunning find for me to learn that, you know, many people perhaps in your listening audience, if they've been following what sometimes is called neoliberalism, what sometimes is called free market fundamentalism, they might have heard that Milton Friedman went to Chile 2 years after this brutal coup that killed several thousand people to advise the Pinochet junta, this military junta, on how to combat inflation and advise very draconian measures that you know hurt a lot of people. But it turns out that Buchanan's role in Chile was actually more important and is felt to this very day. And the story is this: Buchanan was invited in 1980. This is after Chilean operatives had assassinated Letelier, on the streets of Washington, D.C.
Yes.
at rush hour with an American who was with him, assassinated them. So they were pariahs for the U.S. State Department. But Buchanan, and the news of the human rights violation was throughout the world press at this point, and they actually just shut down the universities, key people in the, you know, universities, any dissent in the universities. And Buchanan went over as a guest of the regime and its civilian allies in Chile's capitalist class in 1980 to advise on a constitution that could lock in what the dictatorship had achieved by repressing the whole population, you know, ending trade unions, stopping rural people from organizing, students, etc., and suppressing all dissent. Now they knew that they had to go back eventually to elected rule in order to survive internationally, but they wanted to keep everything they got and try to make it as permanent as possible. So that's where Buchanan came in. He was invited in. He gave a series of lectures, many of them to regime audiences, and basically spelled out how they could draft such a constitution to achieve that constitutional revolution that he had talked about. And the regime adopted the things that he had proposed. And to this day, Chile has found that popular hands are tied for any kind of thoroughgoing reforms. In 2013, about two-thirds of the people elected Michelle Bachelet president, and there was really deep demand to address college, which had become the most expensive in the developed world in Chile, to address the privatization of education, which was creating horrible inequality, privatization of pensions, etc. And Michelle Bachelet found that this constitution prevented her from acting on even two-thirds of what the Chilean people wanted. She called it a constitution of locks and bolts.
Wow.
And that is exactly what Buchanan was urging, these kinds of locks and bolts on the popular will, and that is now the kind of constitution that this Koch donor network and its various, you know, hangers-on and allies are pushing through in America, you know, going back to our discussion earlier about the call for a constitutional convention. That's what they want to do, put in a constitution of locks and bolts. So that I have a chapter on that Chilean story, and I think that really will help people to understand the kind of liberty that these people think is desirable.
Well, and many of my listeners are familiar with Naomi Klein's book, Shock Doctrine, mm-hmm. and I think that you have extended at least our understanding of the Chilean application of Chicago school economics in a very interesting way. Professor, how did Buchanan wind up winning the Nobel Prize in Economics in 1986? Who greased that?
Yeah, well, one thing I think that's very interesting for listeners to learn is that the Nobel Prize in Economics is not like the other Nobel Prizes. So, you know, we have Nobel Peace Prize, Nobel Prize in Literature, et cetera. And those were created by Alfred Nobel right at the turn of, you know, opening of the 20th century to recognize these great humanitarian achievements. The Nobel Prize in Economic Science is different. It was created after he was dead, and it was funded by a Swedish bank, and it has always been much more to promote a kind of, you know, right-wing economic thought. So some people, like Gunnar Myrdal, won at one point, the Swedish social democrat, and Paul Krugman, the liberal economist who writes for the New York Times, you know, he was awarded it. But if you look at the winners over the years, they do tend to be much more these kind of free market fundamentalists, mm-hmm. people from the right. So I think that's an interesting thing to know. But Buchanan won in 1986, and, you know, at a time when the prize was moving right, as were American politics and also, you know, Thatcher in England and Pinochet in Chile and so forth. But Buchanan won for developing this new school of political economy, which I mentioned earlier, public choice political economy, and also for his new work in this domain of constitutional economics, where he was talking about various ways that you could redesign constitutions in order to get different outcomes.
Well, Professor McLean, you have really done a great job here of defining James Buchanan, the movement that he has enabled, the threats that it poses to true democracy, and the elements of progressivism, as you said, going back even beyond the New Deal. And I really want to recommend your book to my listeners, because I think that it's an important set of aspects of American history that need to be further explored and more widely understood. As we wrap up here, there's much more in your book that we don't have time to cover. Mm-hmm. But is there anything that we haven't mentioned here that you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Thank you for offering me that opportunity. And I would say there's one thing, because I think at this point, if people have listened to the whole interview, they might be feeling very scared. It's a pretty chilling story, and what is happening is pretty frightening. A few people have said, compared reading the book to a Stephen King novel. I'm not a Stephen King fan, but I get the point that it's frightening. And so what I would also like to leave people with is this one point, and I'm telling audiences it's the single most important thing to take from the book and from my research. In my research, I found that Buchanan and Koch and these, you know, people that are working with them, working to effect this change, they are operating in the way they are operating because they know they will never persuade the majority if they tell the truth openly and honestly about what their goals are, about what they want to see happen, and what their end game is. And therefore, they use a lot of misleading rhetoric. You know, they talk about the pro-growth policies or limited government or all these anodyne phrases that don't sound at all frightening and mm-hmm. many people vote for. But what they are seeking to impose is not just something that liberals would oppose or moderates. Even Republican conservative voters would oppose this agenda. And people need to know it, therefore, and know what's going on. And I think when people do, when they realize that this cause is operating in stealth in the way that it is, because, again, it knows it's a permanent, tiny minority cause when it tells the truth, I think people will realize that they are part of a majority, of a latent majority that can be patiently informed and activated. If they don't like what's happening, if they're frightened of this, the key thing they can do is inform other people and activate that latent majority to stop it. And so actually, I think in the end, there's also a hopeful message. And that's what many readers have been saying to me, and you know, that they actually feel empowered by this. I finally understand why all this craziness is happening, where all these things are coming from, and they also feel like now they know what they need to do. And so that has been really gratifying to me as an author.
Nancy McLean is professor of history and public policy at Duke University. Her important new book is Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Peter. It's really been a pleasure.
Let me know your comments and feedback. Email Peter at peterbcollins.com. And thanks again to John Zweibel.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.